Welcome to the Biomedical Frontiers podcast, where we explore pivotal research projects and disruptive innovations aimed at translating scientific advancements into tangible healthcare solutions. I'm your host, Dasha Tischler.
You've been named the research director for the University of Virginia Focused Ultrasound Cancer Immunotherapy Center, which, as you mentioned, is actually the first center of its kind in the world. What does that role mean, and what are you trying to shape within that center?
Really fortifying our translational pipeline to get more things into the clinic and also bring more devices to UVA that would facilitate further clinical adoption. I've been really impressed and heartened to see how willing clinicians are to explore the technology, work with it, advocate for it, and similarly how willing patients have been. In the next 20 years or so, we will have the right convergence of technologies to be able to do that tuning and iteration in real time in patients.
Welcome, everybody, to the Biomedical Frontiers, where we tell stories of innovators in healthcare. On the show today, we have Dr. Natasha Shibani. Her group at University of Virginia focuses on non-invasive techniques for precision oncology, specifically pioneering and advancing the work of using focused ultrasound immunotherapy for brain and breast cancer. Dr. Natasha studied at University of Virginia for her PhD, at Virginia Commonwealth University for her undergraduate, and did her postdoc at Stanford University, where she was also a visiting professor. Today, she is on the board of an NIH team for oncology, and she is also recently named 30 Under 30 for Forbes in Science. Dr. Natasha Shibani, it's such a pleasure to have you. I'd like to get started first learning a little bit about your background. You're an emerging scientist in an emerging field. You're young, extremely accomplished, super high energy. What drives you? How did you get into this field?
First of all, I want to thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be on this podcast and having the opportunity to share a bit about my journey and what we do is really a treat. So, I am fundamentally two things, biomedical engineer. And these days I get to call myself most days a cancer researcher. And so, you know, much of my journey in biomedical engineering was shaped by my very early years of study. So I did my undergraduate and PhD in BME, but even predating that, I think I started my earliest lab experience at the age of 14 in a biomedical engineering lab, where I first gained exposure to the topics of biomaterials and drug delivery. And that really fueled my interests for several years spanning through undergrad. It was really quite serendipitous the way that I fell into my current field, focused ultrasound. When I interviewed at UVA, I was very fortunate to actually meet our now department chair, Dr. Shane Pierce Kotler, who was very gracious in sort of, you know, introducing me to the program. And during that process of interviewing with the program, I started to very quickly realize that Charlottesville is almost like a microcosm for focused ultrasound research. So much of the pioneering work was born out of this institution's and many great investigators' efforts, but also the Focused Ultrasound Foundation, which happens to be headquartered here in Charlottesville, is a major catalyst for the research as well. So having recognized all of that pretty early, I think I was fortunate to then just follow that lead and enter the domain of image-guided therapy, image-guided drug delivery. That brought me to my PhD studies at the University of Virginia. And since that time, I have been centered on the topic of cancer immunotherapies, and specifically thinking about how we can make them better, how we can make them work for more people who have very challenging and complex disease states, and finally, how we can make them less cumbersome for patients, whether that's through the lens of, you know, safety profile, toxicity, et cetera. We are really centered as a lab on the patient experience, and that's something that I'm going to tell you a lot more about during this podcast.
So you call your research explicitly translational, and you focus specifically on ideas that can then be translated clinically. How does this impact the everyday work of the people in your lab, as well as the mindsets and professional practices that you actually employ?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I think as much as it might seem like a trivial consideration to just say we do translational research, I have found that in practice it is not. And what I mean by that is simply the fact that when we're putting the patient experience at the center of what we do, or the clinical practicalities for translation at the center of what we do, what often that results in is like very pragmatic decisions at the bench side to do what is in alignment with clinic, do what is most accessible to a clinician that might be executing these procedures, or even using therapies that might be most accessible to the patients that would be undergoing said procedures. So for instance, we do a lot of work in my lab combining various flavors of focused ultrasound, as I call them, with immunotherapies. And that requires sort of a multifaceted decision tree for what is translationally relevant on the immunotherapy side, as well as what's translationally relevant on the clinical side. So we love to do basic discovery. Of course, you know, getting to just do the science and drill into hypotheses is a really fun part of what we get to do. But given the choice to tune that to better meet possibilities for, say, a future clinical trial, we will make that choice 10 out of 10 times. The other thing I will just add to that is the way that I train my students is also very much centered on the human impact of the work that we do. And we like to keep that thinking about the patient experience at the forefront, because our work really has no meaning at the end of the day if we're unable to see it through to the benefit of cancer patients. And so actually a lot of my emerging efforts just as an early investigator these days have been centered on finding more ways to personally connect with, like, for instance, we do breast cancer research. So with breast cancer survivors or thrivers, as we call them, but also creating better interfaces for those patients and even patient advocates to learn about what we're doing at sort of this cutting edge of new possibilities for breast cancer care, and similarly creating those opportunities for my students and for trainees so that they don't necessarily feel as siloed at the bench side and can cultivate some real world context quickly to fuel what they do.
Can you provide some examples of how you actually practically get some of that feedback early on, and how that's maybe changed the course of some of your research when you started doing that?
Absolutely. So I would say, practically speaking, there are a few ways that I have navigated dialogues to inform our translational focus. And a big part of that that I will mention first is interaction with clinicians. I have to say, I feel so incredibly fortunate, and I can't emphasize this enough, to be at an institution like the University of Virginia, and specifically within this umbrella of focused ultrasound research, because we really do have an enterprise here that facilitates crosstalk between folks who are on the basic discovery side or engineers like myself and clinicians. And in fact, the BME department itself is such a great exemplar for this, because even our department is physically co-located between, you know, the School of Medicine and the hospital. So like we even have those opportunities to just happen upon translational conversations organically. So with that being said, I say that clinicians are a big part of that conversation, because I think from the very beginning of my training, I've had the good fortune of having a seat at the table with clinicians and also having access to them for feedback. So whether it was through kind of just passively, like, you know, receiving information and using that internally to kind of think about what I was doing, or whether it was through specifically putting what I was doing in front of someone and getting feedback, I've constantly been a beneficiary of that crosstalk with our clinical collaborators. And this is true in the work we do with neurosurgery, oncologists, surgical oncologists, et cetera. We really have like a clinician in virtually every domain we're working in that we work with closely, again, because the ultimate goal is to spin things into clinical trials and or understand information from ongoing clinical trials. So I often point to the example of not just forward translation, but reverse translation. those opportunities are also very contingent on having a good relationship with our clinicians so that when they are running the trials, we're able to learn from them as quickly and efficiently as possible. And so, again, I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to our clinical colleagues who have really been partners in everything we do. And I'll point to one great example of where that partnership resulted in a really beautiful thing here at UVA. So back when I was a PhD student, we were doing work applying a specific mode of focused ultrasound in conjunction with chemotherapy. But the interesting thing is that we were repurposing that chemotherapy to induce an immune response against breast cancer. So fundamentally, we were taking a chemo that's pretty well tolerated, pretty safe from a clinical perspective, and re-envisioning its use in conjunction with focused ultrasound. So the reason I emphasize that is because This created a platform that would be pretty ripe for translation. Like, the barrier to entry was reasonable. And we had clinical colleagues who were very excited about pushing that frontier forward. So when we published our preclinical work demonstrating efficacy of this combination, our clinical collaborators, specifically Dr. David Brennan and Dr. Patrick Dillon, took that paradigm and actually wrote it up for FDA and IRB approval, which has now turned into a clinical trial known as BR54, which is open here at UVA and currently enrolling patients. So, you know, what we did in the span of less than 5 years in mice, we were able to realize in the clinic as what is now an ongoing clinical trial that my lab, which has since been established at UVA, is now interfacing with. And so we'll get to understand things in a very unique way by virtue of that cycle. And that's the cycle that fuels everything my lab does now. I'd love to see that continue in the work we do.
So that's really positive in terms of the speed to translate a promising idea to a feasible therapy, because my understanding is, and particularly in the field of oncology and therapies that have sometimes also bad side effects, like chemotherapy, the path to from we have a promising idea to it's actually usable and has been validated and is safe and been adjusted to how it's going to actually function can be, what, like a decade or more?
Absolutely. So your point is very true. And I have to say the circumstance I was referring to is a very unique and fortunate one where we sort of had years of work predating each of those therapies to make them ripe enough for combination at the time that we came in with that preclinical work. However, there are many exceptions to that that usually involve a much longer path to clinic. And that's obviously one that we will be just as equipped to travel on. Where the situation necessitates it. But the great news for focused ultrasound technology that I just want to emphasize is it's really, it has become clinically advanced enough for a number of indications that we really are at an inflection point, both institutionally and just globally, where we can effectively bring our preclinical studies to bear more quickly, I would argue. And again, that does require some intention at the bench side to know where those opportunities exist and how we can get ourselves there most efficiently. However, yeah, I will just emphasize that I can't make this generalization to like every biomedical innovation. I wish I could, but that's why preclinical research is so important and why I take so much joy in performing it, because it's sort of the fundamental foundation.
So let's dive in into some of the specific research and technologies that you're working on right now. You have a paper that recently came out about the use of focused ultrasound with immunotherapy for a very aggressive brain cancer, glioblastoma. And can you kind of walk us through, first of all, what is focused ultrasound therapies in general, and where your research fits into the scale of that technology? And then how that combines with immunotherapy, precision oncology, to be applied to that specific cancer.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've alluded to focused ultrasound many times. I may as well give a bit of a primer on what it is. So focused ultrasound is basically a technology that, again, is now available clinically for a variety of different mechanisms of action. I just want to preface with that. One of the strengths of the technology is that it's highly versatile. But all of that versatility stems from a basic physical principle where we are taking sound waves and projecting them into the body in a manner where where the sound waves are concentrated into a single ellipsoid volume. So that volume can vary. I will just liken it to something on the order of a grain of rice to give you some context for how small our perturbations to the tissue can be. But basically, by tuning the physics of these sound waves, we can begin to exert all kinds of different bioeffects within that focal volume in a manner that is completely non-invasive, in a manner that is completely non-ionizing, and in a manner that is safe and repeatable. So with all of that in mind, again, there are a number of things we can do in that focal volume, and these generally range from being thermal to mechanical in nature. So I can, for instance, heat up a tissue to very high temperatures and destroy it. I can also mechanically perturb a tissue and basically like run it through a very precise blender, if you will. I can also lower the intensity of those bioeffects and do other things like disrupt physical barriers within the tissue temporarily. So the study you alluded to used a mechanism of action known as blood-brain barrier opening to basically enable increased therapeutic delivery into the brain. And also we can do sublethal heating and other lower intensity mechanical perturbations as well. So the reality is the list goes on and on and on. The only things that we change are a handful of acoustic parameters, and these can give way to all kinds of different bioeffects. So to me, one of the major beauties of this technology and why I love studying it as an engineer is because we have these many ways that we can begin to perturb biology through physics. And so while many of our problems start with the physics, you ask what my lab does. Well, we're very interested in understanding the biology. And we are specifically in this niche of cancer immunobiology, meaning we're very interested in understanding how these sound waves can ultimately impact the immune response against cancer. We call that immunomodulation. And we are also very interested in understanding how those same sound waves might enable us to improve access of various therapeutics to cancers like brain tumors, for instance. And so that sort of falls more under the category of immunotherapy delivery. And there are many, many things in between as we think about this nexus of focused ultrasound and cancer immunotherapy that my lab incorporates to better understand these problems and how we might be overcoming them with focused ultrasound, but also to arrive at another term you alluded to, which is precision oncology. So precision oncology basically refers to this notion that medicine is not one size fits all. Certainly cancer medicine is not, because cancer is just so complicated. And where we have that complexity, the more we can understand about the cancer at baseline and about how it is evolving in response to therapy, the more we can arm ourselves with the right tools to combat the cancer in an individualized manner. On paper, this sounds great. Obviously, in practice, it's a very challenging task. And with such a nascent technology as focused ultrasound, the reason I'm very excited about precision oncology is because we're really in an era of being able to start early with the types of readouts and the types of considerations that we need to make to eventually get the technology to that point of precision. Another reason that precision oncology is so central to focused ultrasound, my argument is that it is inherently a very precise technology. So when you have something that is so spatially tunable and so manipulable in the way that we can control bioeffects, I would argue that it lends very well to a precision oncology approach where we know what the needs are for the precision. So
thinking about your research, where it is in terms of the field of focused ultrasound is nascent, the concept of precision oncology nascent.
Mm-hmm.
Can you compare sort of what, for example, for brain tumors and brain cancers, what the standard of care is right now? And what, not the near term, maybe not this upcoming next study, but what the next 20 years might transform that to look like in terms of what the patient experiences, how the doctor actually treats the patient, incorporating some of these concepts of things being more specific to the patient, specific to whatever their biology is.
Absolutely. So, you know, I do think that within the next 20 years, with all of the technologies that we're seeing develop right now around the space of brain cancer therapy in particular, we really are going to see that precision oncology era brought to bear in a meaningful way. That can, of course, take a lot of shape. So I'll kind of limit my answer a little bit. First, going to the matter of the clinical problem that you asked about. So, you know, the reality is, and I'll stick to primary brain tumors for this, but, you know, glioblastoma, for instance, is the most common and aggressive brain cancer in adults. Part of the issue therein is that it's a highly infiltrative, diffuse disease in the brain. So often when physicians go to execute the standard of care, which has not evolved for decades, it is surgical resection, chemotherapy, and radiotherapy. When clinicians execute the standard of care, unfortunately, the prognosis for most patients still remains pretty dismal. The reality is that often patients do recur, and often that recurrence is because of the tumor cells that we cannot detect. And because it's such an infiltrative disease, it is very hard for physicians to effectively combat every single cell or eradicate every single cell that it might have floated off within the brain. So with this challenge of recurrences in mind, we have, of course, gravitated to thinking about immunotherapy, among many others, as a way of not just targeting, you know, the tumor bulk, but really training the immune system to recognize and target what might be distal lesions or, in the case of GBMs, those highly infiltrative cells that eventually give way to recurrence. Another totally different way to think about this, and this is now projecting into kind of my 20-plus year vision, is, you know, obviously we have a lot to do to make immunotherapies effective in that setting. So that's baked into what I hope will be the next few decades. But there are two other things I'll just point out to be a little more provocative. One is that, you know, a longstanding challenge for us with the advent of things like blood-brain barrier opening is understanding how much is enough for a given patient, right? So if I tell you I can deliver this immunotherapy across the blood-brain barrier, I don't necessarily have a good benchmark for how much of that immunotherapy needs to get there to be effective. And also, when I have performed this procedure, I don't necessarily have a great benchmark for knowing how much I delivered. So the study you referenced earlier, where we were leveraging a specific form of molecular imaging called immunoPET imaging, actually involved us trying to answer those questions more definitively for the first time by saying, if I can visualize my therapy, can I actually see that focused ultrasound improved its penetrance? And secondary to that, is that sufficient to result in efficacy? I would argue that in the next 20 years or so, we will have the right convergence of technologies to be able to do that tuning and iteration in real time in patients. And this is something that, you know, without revealing too much in the interest of time, that myself and a few colleagues at UVA are fervently working towards, just to get like the right equipment and the right interests together to establish such opportunities at UVA going forward. The second thing I'll mention is, you know, one of the very cool things about FUS technology is that now people are intersecting it with synthetic biology, or and that basically means that we can engineer things to be responsive to sound waves. So now you can imagine almost like having a very targeted molecule that resides within the body, but that can only be activated when it's exposed to a sound wave. So, you know, the focused ultrasound is almost like a remote control for activating the therapy. Similarly, we now have other types of molecules that can be uptaken selectively by cancer cells. This is in alignment with another regimen known as sonodynamic therapy. And the principle there is that only those cells that have uptaken the molecule or the sonosensitizer would be responsive to the sound waves and undergo cell killing as a function of sound wave exposure, leaving everything else that's healthy and naive intact. So I've just given you three instead of two possibilities for how, with more specificity and more engineering, we might actually be able to tackle really complex diseases like GBM more effectively.
One of the things that you mentioned as a part of this research, you're also at the more basic level, just understanding what the blood-brain barrier opening, like what the effect of that can be in terms of delivery of, in this case, immune response. But are there other applications that you see of this technology and the basic foundation that you're laying forth in terms of understanding how the blood-brain actually uptake modulation, that tuning is going to work? Where else could this become applicable in the near future?
Yeah, I think specifically in the context of blood-brain barrier, I mean, there are all kinds of interesting things happening in our field right now. So I gave you sort of these very basic examples of, you know, we have a drug that we need to enrich in a certain location. And the question becomes, can we achieve that effectively with blood-brain barrier opening? The same principle to some extent can be translated to, you know, cells. So there are some people thinking about delivery of stem cells. Our lab is also thinking about engineered T cells or CAR T cells. And so, you know, that principle of just overcoming delivery problems could be extended to a number of different therapeutic categories. However, as I mentioned, there are also those who are sort of using ultrasound less as like a method to open the floodgates and more as like a remote control, which I think is really interesting. So now thinking about ways to actually activate a therapy locally by exposing, you know, that agent to sound waves. That's sort of a different take on the blood-brain barrier opening principle. Like I said, our lab is also delving into some of the more nuanced impacts of the same regimen, the same types of sound waves, but not so much in the therapeutic delivery context, instead in the immunomodulation or tissue modulation context. So there's, you know, growing evidence for this notion that focused ultrasound exposure at baseline can impact the immune milieu, as I call it. So, you know, whether systemically or locally, when you poke the system with a sound wave, it's very likely, and the immune system often responds in a Newtonian way. So, like, it's very likely you're going to see something. We've been working very hard to capture what that something is and whether it can actually be leveraged in a meaningful way. And in cases where we don't want it, we want to characterize it equally to understand how we can sort of avoid that effect. So that's, you know, yet another principle that extends from blood-brain barrier opening. But departing from that theme entirely, I can tell you that there are a lot of other ways that focused ultrasound is being used in the brain, for instance, that are really going to open up the doors for what I consider to be, you know, completely different indications and possibly even like enhancement of human performance, more so than just like overcoming symptoms of pathology. With the advent of things like neuromodulation, we're really looking at, you know, the possibility to alter and control, you know, neurological circuits to the extent that we understand them well enough. And so there's totally this really interesting intersection of neuroscience and focused ultrasound technology that I'm not speaking to, but people are thinking about ways to exploit that for overcoming addiction, for controlling pain, managing chronic pain, for instance, for other applications like epilepsy, other psychiatric disorders, for instance. I mean, the list can really go on and on, but that's a whole side of this technology that I am not really going to get to elaborate on in this podcast. So I mention it to impress upon those who are interested that there's a lot more that you could learn about.
So recently you've been named the research director for the University of Virginia Focused Ultrasound Cancer Immunotherapy Center, which, as you mentioned, is actually the first center of its kind in the world. What does that role mean, and what are you trying to shape within that center?
Yeah, so again, had the very good fortune of getting to kind of see this center go from a concept to a real entity here at UVA, and this dates all the way back to when I was a grad student here. The Focused Ultrasound Cancer Immunotherapy Center's core mission is basically to foster this emerging strength that we have as an institution in the discovery and translation of work at this intersection of FUS technology and cancer immunotherapy. And what it's really facilitated for us is hiring more personnel, funding additional new projects, and also really fortifying our translational pipeline to get more things into the clinic and also bring more devices to UVA that would facilitate further clinical adoption. So believe it or not, all of that is baked into the mission of the center. As research director, a major part of my role is sort of overseeing some of those dynamics, but more specifically, keeping a finger on the pulse of the research activities here at UVA. So practically speaking, it means, you know, our funding mechanisms and progress of funded projects sort of fall under my purview. And I get to work closely with our steering committee as well as the Focused Ultrasound Foundation to administer that side of the center. From a personal perspective, what it has also meant for my lab is that, you know, we really, you know, being centered on this exact topic, are getting to benefit from a very timely and meaningful investment in this space that's really propelling our work, you know, farther and faster than I could have ever imagined as a very early stage investigator.
And what about in terms of the clinician and patient side? What should patients expect with the center being opened at UVA in the next few years?
Well, I think first and foremost, what patients can hopefully derive from this is that UVA is truly, has been distinguished, let's say, as a growing leader in this space, and of course is increasingly being known as a center of excellence for the advancement of focused ultrasound and cancer immunotherapy. I can actually point to an example for why that's especially true by going all the way back to several years ago when UVA became home to the world's first clinical trial to combine focused ultrasound with an immunotherapy. And that just so happened to be focused ultrasound with a drug called pembrolizumab, which is like a classic form of immunotherapy that unfortunately doesn't work very well in breast cancer patients. So they were deploying this combination in metastatic breast cancer patients. We are currently, you know, that trial is now closed. We're analyzing the data and hoping to publish it very soon. But all of that is to say, like for a patient on the outside of this space looking in, I hope that what they would derive from that is really the active role of our clinicians and the true expertise that exists here for this particular space. I'm always, I continue to be surprised in my interactions with patients about how few might still have the awareness we might expect of the technology. And that's why I'm so keen on getting out into the community more and also interfacing with clinicians who are keen on relaying the messaging about the technology and adopting it early. So again, all of that is kind of baked into the clinical and patient side of things, because again, this center is really, giving our clinicians the opportunity to enter this space where maybe they're interested in the technology and want to write their own trials. But also for those who are in it already, it's really like fueling that momentum that they already have even more.
So turning to your role also as an educator and a professor, how is the work that you're doing in the research and in the guidance of the center, how's that translating into both, you know, you mentioned patient education is a passion. How is that information proliferating? And then what else are you doing in terms of education here at UVA?
Absolutely. So, you know, I would say the patient education piece we talked about, and, I could certainly go on and on about that, but I'll pivot to the second part of your question just to address that despite how much I've talked about research, there is a whole other facet of this very fun job that I get to do, and it is teaching. So, you know, I just this fall began teaching our biomechanics core class here in the biomedical engineering department. And what that means is that I have the good fortune of interacting with mostly our second year students who have just entered the curriculum, and specifically interacting with them on this subject that is very dynamic. You know, it's a lot of physics and math, but fundamentally it's one of the first times they get to see all of that applied to the human body, which is really like in the essence of biomedical engineering. So it's a really fun class for me to teach. The reason I mention it is because, of course, being me and being a very excited excited focused ultrasound researcher, I have even found ways to incorporate some themes from, you know, the research and from, you know, the real world applications into my biomechanics class, including bringing guest lecturers that might get to speak more to, you know, specific new applications that are of interest to the students. And I always make sure they include focused ultrasound technology. But, you know, jokes aside, I would say a big part of the educational mission for me has manifested in, like, you know, patient and student education in the classroom. But there's another very real dimension of that that exists within the lab. So, you know, I think that for even students, say undergraduate students who hear the messaging and ideally see someone who's really loving what they do and also sees the passion that's carried forward by the culture of a lab that is centered on what I hope is a pretty wholesome mission, we've, you know, been able to recruit a lot of undergraduate researchers through that, you know, collective. And I've realized that that is a whole separate and interesting opportunity to educate students early and in a very different way, because it again, like, is an opportunity to link the research to the bedside, and we send students to the clinic to observe these procedures and gain context for what they're going to be thinking about in the lab. So I think education has been central to my mission as an academician in so many ways, but I've never, like, shied away from the opportunity to interface with a new audience wherever that might present. And that's, of course, why I'm so thrilled to be on this podcast as well.
Well, I have heard fantastic things about you as an instructor from your students. So that's why I wanted to bring that up, because if, you know, obviously it's a required class, so they all have to take it, but True. It's probably also one of the harder classes they have to take. But great feedback on your classes from students.
That's fantastic.
If you're not in the biomedical engineering department and you're thinking about biomechanics, you should take the class. So, kind of switching topics a little bit, diving back into a technology, precision medicine in general. Can you kind of educate us a little bit more about where that's heading, not just in oncology, but broadly? And is there a role that focused ultrasound plays in those types of treatments for other diseases, maybe kind of deviating from the brain topic?
Yeah, I would say, again, absolutely is my answer. And to the specific question of, you know, does focused ultrasound have a role to play? And I'll just speak to that very briefly to say the way I think about precision is, again, sort of multifaceted. So we can think of precision in the very literal sense of, can I be precise, for instance, with how I spatially target a tumor or another disease? At the end of the day, I think that, you know, focused ultrasound fits so nicely into that very literal interpretation of precision medicine, because, again, we have a tool that we can theoretically tune with sub-millimeter precision in most cases. So, you know, take that as you will, but I think my take-home message there is, like, yes, focused ultrasound can be used to achieve precision. The limitations on the more figurative interpretation of precision, like, you know, how do we time things? How do we combine things? Who will benefit the most from what? All of that falls into a much broader dialogue and discourse that is really ubiquitous to all flavors of therapy, right? And unfortunately, focused ultrasound is no exception to that. So what I mean is, again, if we take, you know, any disease, we are likely going to be met with a situation where the mainstay of therapy for that disease may not be sufficient and may not even be effective for everybody. So the first challenge therein is identifying the shortcomings, right? The second challenge is then figuring out, once therapy is being deployed, if those shortcomings have been, you know, surmounted effectively. And so this really brings me into the realm of, like, surveillance and monitoring. So again, I'll kind of link this back to how we're thinking about things as a lab. You know, we are very interested in bringing other tools online that are going to enable us to monitor and surveil things in a meaningful way. And baked into that is, of course, the concept that surveillance is longitudinal. The challenge is, like, again, in cancer, that if you want to take a biopsy from a patient, you can't go biopsy them every week, right? So what do? Or in a case where a tumor is in a very challenging location, maybe it's not amenable to biopsy at all. What do you do? there are a lot of people much smarter than I am that are trying to actually answer those questions. And some of that has led to the burgeoning field of liquid biopsy. So the idea that something like a blood draw could actually offer meaningful surrogate biomarkers for what's happening inside a tumor or, again, in another pathological context. That's something we're working on right now in the lab, is kind of using liquid biopsy as a readout alongside the studies we're doing.
Can you tell a little bit more about what that means?
Yeah, so liquid biopsy basically refers to any sampling of any bodily fluid. So as gross as it sounds, this could mean urine. It can also mean blood, cerebrospinal fluid. And taken together, the concept is that, at least in the case of cancer, there are things that are shed into each of those fluids. And those things that are shed into these fluids are basically reflective of what is going on with the tumor. So instead of having to take a very invasive punch biopsy from some arbitrary location inside a tumor, I might be able to glean something meaningful just by taking a blood draw. And that is not only far less invasive and more favorable, but far more amenable to repetition, let's say. So that's really where the strengths of liquid biopsy shine, because, again, the most like common form is, of course, blood draws. And where we have the ability to collect those blood draws, we're only limited by the information we can garner from them. So now there's a lot of effort going into utilizing liquid biopsy in various ways to either like perform risk stratification up front, surveil and adapt treatment downstream of intervention. And all in all, it's about the biomarkers now. It's about figuring out what's actually meaningful. Another place where liquid biopsy has gained a really important role, and I just don't want to overlook this, is early cancer detection. So speaking of where we're headed, you know, early cancer detection is a huge area unto itself. And I would say that is in particular an area where things like liquid biopsy are poised to play a really powerful role. In fact, they are already. If I were to add another dimension to that, because I was talking about monitoring and surveillance, I would add imaging. So the reality is our imaging capabilities, when you look over the last few decades, have excelled in huge ways, right? So what we can now glean without having to cut into the body is hugely enabling for what we can do to like monitor and surveil disease. So again, taking advantage of that, our lab is also thinking about ways to couple longitudinal imaging approaches, specifically immunoimaging approaches, let's say, with our focused ultrasound interventions. And these are just two ways among many ways that we might envision starting to be more precise in a manner that I would then argue lends to precision medicine. I mean, precision medicine for some people might mean something way more fundamental, like understanding somebody's genetics and then, you know, kind of reverse engineering interventions from there. So we certainly could get that granular, but I'm giving you sort of the more practical answer for how we are realistically executing things right now. Obviously, I think that all of these things have room where something like cancer is involved, just because it is such an incredibly complex disease.
So kind of putting on a hat of being empathetic to the difficulty of and the complexity of getting technologies like this out into the world, not only first from a scientific perspective of just establishing, you know, how does this really work and where are the bounds of where safety is. But then also there's a secondary aspect, which is, you know, obviously doctors want to do their best, but the amount of new technologies coming out is large. And then there's this big paradigm shift from kind of, you know, surgical approach or single cancer or single issue, single treatment, and we kind of try them out one at a time. What you're describing is a continuous monitoring over, you know, before the cancer is even really detectable, trying to figure out if it might be there through the blood, then combining, you know, these combination therapies, things that stimulate the immune system, things that then are more aggressive, delivering various drugs, and making it super specific to the individual and their immune system and their biology. How do you see, just in terms of bringing this technology to bear, from my perspective, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, it's so much to have to learn, and it's a completely different way of doing medicine, where instead of, you know, what this treatment is for sure for this situation, you now have this significant, even greater amount of discretion and choices and combinations of things that are being advocated for the patient, but the complexity is huge. How do you think that's just education? How do we get through that? How do we make that possible and manageable?
Absolutely. So let me start by just making the joke that, you know, you mentioned all of these multifaceted things, and the conclusion there is that what I'm proposing is very expensive. So I have become very skilled at running what is effectively a very expensive lab at the moment, because as you said, we're like, let's pick the most expensive immunotherapy and combine it with the most expensive imaging. And I joke about that only to say that there is actually a reality to these considerations that maybe is not so funny, in that, you know, when clinicians are making the considerations for what they should have their patients undergo, there is like a clinical practicality element, as you were saying. There is the comfort of the patient and the safety of the patient to keep in mind. And then, of course, there's the expense. So, I mean, you know, the cost considerations also for many of these things are not trivial. And that's, again, why I think our conversations and linkage to the clinic are so integral, because sometimes those conversations come up way sooner than I'd expect. Now, in some cases, we may still go the lengths of sorting things out preclinically where we can. But again, for translational purposes, sometimes there are way more considerations than, you know, than we will have time to frame here. And that might dictate how readily something can be adopted. So now, to your point about adoption, you're absolutely right. I mean, medicine is evolving so rapidly. I have sort of held my tongue until now not to say the phrase AI, but there's an elephant in the room for everyone these days, and that is the fact that we are in the era of artificial intelligence, and we're seeing the way that it is also trickling into the practice of medicine in ways that I only suspect are going to grow larger with time. And same is true of approaches in like virtual reality or augmented reality. We're already seeing where that is changing the way that surgeons are trained or surgeons might function in the OR. Now, again, this might be the conversation of what's to come in decades, but still, I think all of that is to say that, you know, there is a certain agility and adaptability that clinicians are either have, those who are very early adopters, or that they are developing with the way that scientific advancement and technological advancement is happening in parallel with the practice of medicine. So I think now more than ever, we're in an era where adoption might be more welcome, especially for nascent technologies like focused ultrasound. There's a lot of advocacy work and fundraising and, you know, spreading the word type effort that also goes into that. And I do think that those efforts carry a lot of weight to, you know, convince people to learn about and use the technology. But I mean, fundamentally, I think that that really is a choice that many clinicians are probably making is, you know, how much promise do I see if I have this, you know, armamentarium of tools? How much promise do I see in this one? How much do I want to invest in this one? And what that could mean down the road is very different forms of training for people who want to work with certain technologies. Again, in the focused ultrasound domain, we're already seeing where some of that training is basically requisite for being able to use the technology. It's not that it's necessarily baked into, like, formally into curricula just yet, like at the med school level, but certainly beyond that, the training that people are receiving is becoming more specialized. And you know, I've seen, I don't know enough about the history of that evolution to really know, like, how welcome it has been and how widely this is happening globally. But what I can say is in our little niche of focused ultrasound research, I've been really impressed and heartened to see how willing clinicians are to explore the technology, work with it, advocate for it, and similarly, how willing patients have been to basically, you know, undergo these procedures and you know, trust in the potential of the technology. It really takes all of those things aligning for, you know, technologies to be adopted effectively. And when you really step back to think about that, and maybe I say this because I'm kind of doing this in real time, it's a crazy thing, right? It's a lot of stars that have to align.
And one of the things that's really impressive just talking to you is obviously you're a very young scientist at 30 under 30, but you're already thinking in terms of timelines that are 10, 20 years for your technologies, maybe even longer than that. And that in itself is a very interesting skill to have to develop. It's not something that I could say like anyone's taught me in a class ever in school, but it seems to be a fundamental skill to be able to have research that's very forward-looking and is shaping industry in a meaningful way. How did you develop that? Did you have a mentor? Did you use some of that neuromodulation?
I could use some neuromodulation. There's no question about that. But I will actually credit one specific person. So I mentioned to you, I started very early, you know, tinkering in the labs. And mind you, for those who are, you know, listening to this and are thinking, oh, she was, you know, doing experiments and like really functioning in the lab. No, no. My first job in the lab, and I tell my students this, is for a year, I washed beakers and I made a saline solution, which basically meant like mixing a powder with water and doing that over and over. And I did it so well and so consistently every day that at some point they stopped me. They were like, all right, everything's squeaky clean. And we have way more solution than we know what to do with. So I think all of us can point to some, you know, humble beginning. But in that humble beginning, I think that the mentor that I had actually started to take me kind of seriously, maybe. And now I'm going to tell you what he told me, which is kind of a funny thing to say to like a 14 or 15 year old. He was like, doing science and running a lab is like an exercise in predicting the future. And I actually have really taken that to heart. And I think it's reflected in everything we've talked about because science and engineering move so quickly. And the reality is that as scientists, we are never stagnant. I think that's the fun of the job. We're constantly learning and growing and evolving ourselves to keep up with what's happening. And in a sense, you can only do that effectively if you have some foresight for what might be the next biggest thing or, you know, what might be interesting, where we're going to see gaps in the field. I think about that concept of gaps all the time because I'm like, is this an opportunity to fill some of those? And so that's like a constant back of my mind kind of exercise that I cannot say I've necessarily honed well. I'm still learning how to do it. But to give credit where it's due, it was really like my high school research mentor who first planted that seed to say, to I guess make it okay to think about science through that lens of predicting the future.
So let's do a little bit of that exercise right
Sure.
now. Stepping outside of your lab, is there a technology, doesn't even have to be biomedical, that or area of research and discovery that you are just really positive and gung-ho about, even if you're not the one in the lab actually doing it?
Yeah, it's such an excellent question. And there really are so many things I can point to, but I'm going to give a non-biomedical answer, and I'm going to give the one that might seem somewhat obvious, so I apologize. As I mentioned, we are in an era where AI is burgeoning, and I think I'm actually not going to give like an exclusively super positive answer. Instead, I'm going to say, you know, with generative AI becoming very quickly a part of our lives and something that is developing so rapidly, I do see that as being part of our future. And a lot of days where I just get to be, you know, a bit more of a philosopher than a scientist, I think about what that's going to mean for the future of research, for the future of medical practice, let's say, for the future of teaching and education. This is a really big conversation right now in the university, is figuring out how to embrace what feels like maybe the inevitable. Just as the calculator came along one day, some people are arguing that generative AI came one day, will be something people say decades from now. However, I do think that, you know, there is going to be a social dialogue that emerges about how to protect and preserve skills that we deem valuable societally, and then how we are going to enrich for training and careers that are complementary to, as opposed to in competition with, generative AI. And bringing that all the way back to the conversation we've been having, I think that that is like a very real consideration and sometimes even a fear that comes with any new technology. Like if I tell you I can now destroy a tumor and I don't need a surgeon to remove it, how does that change the worldview of a surgeon in that moment? And I'm not at all submitting that that's what we're going to do, but just to use it as a provocative example, it's very much the same thing. So, you know, at the end of the day, when I look to the future, that is something that feels just very prevalent in my view of it. And so I felt like it's, you know, worth mentioning. But, you know, I think, again, like we're in an era where I just hope, and in part, I hope to be part of this, but like, I hope that we continue to prioritize the conversations that have to do with like the societal impact just as much, and the ethical impact, let's say, of our biomedical or technical innovations just as much as we do, you know, the conversation around the technical and the scientific. And another, just because I'll take the liberty of doing it, another great example I'll point to is like gene editing. We are in that era. The first gene editing therapy for sickle cell just got approved by the FDA. That's going to open up a whole new world of possibilities. And I remember the Nobel Prize winner, Jennifer Doudna, speaking to exactly this, like the conversations around ethics and, you know, establishing sort of the right social framework for the proper adoption of these innovations. So again, I'll stop my laundry list or my soapbox speech there, but I'm so glad you asked the question.
I too am very gung-ho on the AI revolution. And I see in medicine the potential for bringing knowledge and understanding and healthcare management to the fingertips of every patient, and regardless of their educational background. I think that that idea that, first of all, you could take your data and have something that can synthesize it and help you and the doctor, something that can help in the conversational flow with the doctor, you know, you can be like, ChatGPT, explain what just been said to me, you know, yeah. Like at whatever level you need it to be explained at. I think the potential for that to help bring healthcare access to more people in more precise ways with more data being integrated, that to me, I'm super excited about myself. Absolutely. As well as is in other areas such as education, and I see it a lot in marketing right now.
But oh, that's interesting. But your point about like the equity and access piece is so important. And it's something I should have mentioned. And, you know, I think that speaking of positives and the transformative role of you know, AI technologies, if we want to call them that, but, you know, generative AI, that is a huge part of it that I, again, hope that we establish a framework for so that patients have the full ability to exploit those opportunities for improved scientific and medical literacy.
So yeah. Are you exploring language learning models in your lab right now?
I wish I could say we were, but unfortunately, no. I'm very in touch with the space just because of some of my postdoc work back at Stanford. But what we are doing is we're dabbling in AI at the moment in a very superficial way. So there is a project that I have ongoing in the lab where we are taking data from patients who have undergone focused ultrasound procedures here at UVA. And we're basically, so in our pile of data, we have multimodality images, multiparametric images, I should say. So these are MRIs from patients who underwent the focused ultrasound procedure. And then because we have such a long history of doing this procedure, we have long-term outcomes and other clinical variables from these patients. Our mission with these data has been to leverage AI-driven approaches to understand if we can mine information from the images that is predictive of outcomes in those patients. And if not outcomes, then we're also looking to like prediction of side effects, prediction of relapse of their symptoms. So, you know, we have all these endpoints we can look to. And, you know, while I couch it as AI, it's really like a very advanced, like, statistical learning, you know, approach that we're taking. So I won't, you know, overuse the term AI here. The thing it's really setting a precedent for is, again, bringing all of that precision medicine talk that we had earlier full circle by saying, now, if I have the right pieces of information, can I actually predict what might happen to a patient or how effective my therapy was? You can totally extrapolate that to other disease categories like cancer. And at the end of the day, we're sort of using this specific project as a testbed for where we hope to go with our cancer studies. But I will say one of the fundamental things we're trying to figure out right now is, do we have the right data? And do we have the right ways of, interpreting from that data? And these are kind of the fundamental questions that I hope will lend to much more meaningful future efforts.
Well, fantastic. Dr. Shabani, if somebody wanted to follow your research or see if they can get an opportunity in your lab or find out about the cancer center, the Focused Ultrasound Cancer Immunotherapy Center, where should they go to find you?
Several places, and I will list all of them. So I'm active on Twitter at ndshabani. That's my handle, as well as on LinkedIn. So that's sort of my social media scope, unfortunately. But I am also very responsive to emails, whether it's from trainees or folks in the community, potential collaborators. So my email is simply my last name, shabani@virginia.edu. And we also have a web presence online. Our lab website is sort of under construction, but I suspect will be fully launched by the new year. It's currently undergoing a facelift. So those are all the ways to keep in touch with what we do and or reach out. And of course, for those who are local, we are, you know, right in the biomedical engineering department and very open to, you know, keeping in touch and sharing the wealth of efforts that are ongoing in this space.
And you mentioned a couple clinical trials that are maybe ongoing or about to be started. Is there anything that you guys are going to be recruiting for in the next 6 months that people should be aware of?
Absolutely. So all of the information about our clinical trials can be found on our Focused Ultrasound Cancer Immunotherapy website, which can simply be found by Googling UVA Focused Ultrasound Cancer Immunotherapy. It's the first link that comes up, as well as on UVA Health's website. I will just summarize, sort of give a synopsis to say that we have, again, we had one trial that just closed to enrollment. That was with focused ultrasound and immunotherapy. We have another trial, the BR54 trial, that is performing focused ultrasound and gemcitabine treatment in early stage breast cancer patients. We have yet another trial that is going to be, it's under planning and will open soon for another solid tumor indication, very likely melanomas, where again, it'll be focused ultrasound with immunotherapy. And then we have a number of clinical trials that are in the planning stages for brain tumor applications, specifically glioblastoma. I will just highlight one because our lab is involved with this trial. It is about to open, actually. It is applying sonodynamic therapy, which I alluded to very briefly, in recurrent GBM patients, and that is being run out of the neurosurgery department. So for those who are interested, there's plenty of information online, but all of these trials are open, and those who are interested are always welcome to reach out to me or any of our clinical colleagues for more information.
Thank you for such an informative and inspiring interview, Dr. Shabani. It's such a pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Biomedical Frontiers, stories with innovators in healthcare. My name is David Chen, and I am the managing director of the Wallace H. Coulter Center for Translational Research at the University of Virginia. Our mission is to help bring promising new biomedical research and technology into the hands of the provider and the patient. If you found this episode valuable, please let us know by subscribing, following, or sharing. You can learn more about our promising translational research projects on our website. See links in the show notes.